Welcome back to the program. The first rule of medicine is, of course, to do no harm, as it should be the rule of trying to do good in the world. However, as the U.S. and the West committed billions of dollars fighting AIDS in Africa, were we making some fundamental mistakes? Did we approach it in the wrong way over the long run, and did we do more harm than good? This is one of the aspects of the AIDS epidemic that we're going to look at today with my guest, Craig Timberg. He's the former Johannesburg bureau chief for the Washington Post, where over the years he has covered the AIDS epidemic and written dozens of stories about it. He's currently the Washington Post deputy national security editor, and he's the co-author of a new book entitled Tinderbox: How the West Sparked the AIDS Epidemic and How the World Can Finally Overcome It. Craig Timberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Great to have you here. One of the things that you point out is that AIDS as a disease is something that had existed for hundreds of years before there started to be commerce originally in what is Cameroon, and how it unleashed this epidemic.
Well, the precursor to HIV is something called SIV, which many types of simians across Africa have, and it kills many of them. And the scientists theorize that this actually jumped into the human population many times over many years when humans captured and butchered chimps, causing their blood maybe to pass into a human through a cut. What really changed at the crucial moment, and this is right around the beginning of the 20th century, is that in these areas where the chimpanzees who were infected with the precursor to HIV lived, there was new commerce. There were steamships going up the rivers. There were porters carrying material through the jungle, and that seems to have been the trigger for HIV to come out of these very, very remote areas and into places where more people lived and where an epidemic could really brew up.
Talk about it was German colonials that populated the Cameroon area. Talk about what happened and how cities began to spring up in the area.
Well, as you might imagine, in this part of Africa, there were villages, but they were fairly sparse. This was the place where the precursor to HIV was residing. There were actually weren't that many people. It was very dense. It was inhospitable to human population. But what happened is that in the late 1800s, various colonial powers realized you could make a lot of money by collecting ivory, by collecting rubber sap from trees, and selling it back to Europe and the Americas. And so the colonials come in and they take over these areas. They essentially enslave the Africans in these places, and that does two very bad things. It destroys the underlying social architecture of these communities, and it also means that you have this tremendous long range movement through these areas that never existed before. So suddenly you have movement, you have cities, you have changes in the way that sexual mores govern communities, and these become the essential elements, the tinderbox, if you will, of the epidemic.
And it was Leopoldville, what's now Kinshasa, that really became kind of the initial hub of this.
That's right. So imagine the virus sort of coming down the river from this German colonial area, and then it enters into another area that's controlled by the Belgians and is founded by King Leopold. And so King Leopold and his minions build the first major city in this part of Central Africa called Leopoldville. Today it's Kinshasa. So the virus comes down the river on a steamship, and when it reaches Leopoldville, you have lots of men working in very inhumane conditions. You suddenly have a fair bit of prostitution, and you have this tremendous amount of movement. And all throughout that region during this era in the early 20th century, you have this explosion of sexually transmitted diseases, syphilis and chlamydia. And in fact, birth rates throughout the region really plunge because men and women are carrying around these diseases that affect their fertility. And what we didn't know until fairly recently, until genetic scientists made sense of this story, was that HIV was among these sexually transmitted epidemics. It was moving very slowly through this region as population boomed, as commerce boomed.
One of the points that you make repeatedly is that one of the problems in watching the evolution of this and really understanding it is that the disease itself moves and progresses so slowly and exhibits the symptoms of other diseases, and it really took a long time before we realized what was going on.
That's right. So we all remember the horrifying boom of AIDS in the early 1980s in America and Europe, Haiti, and And it's a little hard to reset our clocks, if you will, in terms of understanding how this epidemic really moved. But by the time modern medical science discovered that there was something new, that it wasn't just a strange run of pneumonia and wasting and tuberculosis, it had already been in those places for quite a few years. Even in the late 70s, when they go back and test that blood from this earlier era, they find HIV in measurable amounts. So two crucial things happened that allowed the AIDS epidemic eventually to be discovered. One, HIV found its way out of Kinshasa and into places that were even more hospitable to the spread of this epidemic. And the crucial thing that happens has to do with circumcision. So men who are circumcised are much less likely to contract HIV. And so when, over the course of time, the epidemic moves into areas where men aren't circumcised, as in East Africa and a little bit in Southern Africa, it becomes a much more widespread problem. And then secondarily, modern medical science becomes sophisticated enough so that when the epidemic finds its way over to places like the United States, it gets discovered, the CDC puts out warnings, and suddenly the whole world knows about this thing.
How did the disease spread to places like Haiti?
Well, it looks very much as though you have this sort of historic epidemic in Kinshasa, the former Leopoldville. It's fairly low level, but after the Belgians left rather abruptly in 1960, when Congo becomes an independent nation, the United Nations brought in a whole slew, thousands of French-speaking expatriates to become nurses, to become doctors, to become teachers and technocrats, and some of them came from Haiti. And so when genetic scientists look at the history of this virus, when they sort of piece the story together, they believe that a single infection made its way from Kinshasa in 1960 to Haiti and lands there sometimes in that decade. And it certainly looks as though the UN's efforts to transport people from Haiti to Congo and back was the vector that brought it to Haiti. And once it gets to Haiti, it grows there and eventually spreads to the United States and spreads all the way over to Europe. The genetic scientists who study this believe that every single AIDS death in the Americas and in Europe, save for just a handful, came from that initial spark of infection coming out of Kinshasa in the 1960s.
And how did it spread so widely once it got to the U.S. in the gay community?
Well, there are two crucial factors in this. One of them is that this was an era of gay liberation, and for a time, men, particularly in urban areas, were more likely to have more than one partner at a time. You will recall the bathhouses and such. And sexual behavior is a crucial factor in the spread of any sexually transmitted infection. So if you have one partner at a time, you can only spread an infection to that one partner, who can then maybe spread it to one other partner. But if you're having sex with several people in the same week or month, you create networks of infection that are much more efficient at spreading all kinds of sexually transmitted diseases. The other crucial factor is, and forgive me if this is a little much for your daytime audience, but anal sex is a much more efficient way to spread HIV than other kinds of sex, just because the tissues are more vulnerable to infection.
While it was spreading here and spreading in the West, it was also spreading even more rapidly back in Africa. Talk about what was going on there, and that by the 70s and 80s, the degree to which it had reached epidemic proportions.
The question that really fueled a lot of this work for me and for my co-author, Daniel Halperin, is why is HIV so much worse in some places than others, right? Why is it? Why can you be in Southern Africa and one in four adults have it, and you can be in the Middle East and virtually nobody has it, or one in a thousand people has it? And what you end up, the answer to that question ends up being really two crucial factors. One, as we just discussed, is sexual behavior. If people have more than one partner at a time, you get networks, you get what they call sexual networks, and all kinds of infections spread more rapidly when people have multiple partners. And the other is the factor of circumcision. So in the places in Africa where circumcision is less common, and mainly it's East Africa and Southern Africa, because elsewhere on the continent, just as it is for the Jews and Muslims, circumcising men is an ancient ritual that's thousands of years old. It has to do with coming of age. So in those places where they're not circumcising as often, HIV suddenly goes from being a kind of infection that affects 1 in 100 adults to 1 in 4 adults, 1 in 5 adults. And so you get this really remarkable heterosexually spread epidemic across these parts of Africa that you really don't see many other places in the world.
So part of the problem ultimately becomes that because this is a disease spread by sexual nature, it also becomes a disease that is spread by culture, that culture plays such a large role in it.
That's true, and I think it's only fair to note that that culture is a very changeable thing, and the cultural changes that were going on in Africa in this area have a lot to do with really what the West did to this continent. You know, when we go in there and really undermine village life and build a lot of new cities and build a lot of new transport routes. Now, there may well be some beneficial aspects to that. You know, the West also built universities. They introduced all sorts of infrastructure that had benefits. But at the same time, the essential nature of those societies changed very profoundly. And so if you go back 150 years, in many parts of Africa, the standard way of organizing, marital life was polygamy. The most powerful men had several wives at a time. Now, when the West comes in and the Christian missionaries come in and say, that's not acceptable anymore, you can only marry one person, you get a kind of subtle reaction to that involves something that, frankly, resembles polygamy in many places, but is not quite monogamy as the missionaries would have wanted it. So both men and women, in quite a few cases, end up having more than one partner at a time. And then you overlay onto that the amazing growth of labor migration as people go back and forth to mines for months at a time, or back and forth to factories for months at a time. And the net outcome of this is a kind of sexual culture that's really both quite different from what you see in most other parts of the world, but also very different from what you historically would have had in Africa. I mean, we argue in the book that you go back 150, 200 years, and HIV really could not have spread very easily in many of the places where it's a disaster today.
And one of the more effective ways in which it was dealt with that really takes all of this into account is what you talk about that went on in Uganda in the 80s, their zero grazing campaign.
That's right. Uganda is the most famous case of this, but you do see it in quite a few countries where Africans themselves look at the facts before them, right? There's a disease that's going to kill everyone who gets it. It's spread by sex, and there's no cure, right? So the reaction by the Ugandans beginning in the late 80s is our only hope to survive as a society is to talk very explicitly about sexual behavior. Now, it needs to be noted that didn't mean abstain from sex. It also didn't really mean use condoms for every sexual interaction. What it mainly meant was have fewer partners. If you're in a monogamous relationship, stay monogamous. If you're in a polygamous marriage and the sexual encounters are only happening within that polygamous marriage, stay with that. And so what happened was across society at virtually every level, people had fewer average partners over the course of years. And by all accounts, hundreds of thousands of HIV infections were prevented by that change because the networks that spread the virus really began to break apart. And you see similar things happening over time in Zimbabwe, in Kenya, in Malawi. And that is an incredibly powerful force. They dealt directly with the cause of the spread of this epidemic. It's a remarkable and not very well told part of this story.
And that was very different than the part of the campaigns that were directed just in terms of condoms, for example.
Right. We tend to think AIDS, we think condoms. And that is now true in Africa as well. There are many places in Africa that have the highest reported condom usage rates in the world. And they're much higher than in the United States or Europe. And at the same time, HIV still is transmitted at a very high rate. And the crucial failing of those campaigns was that people got the message that using a condom with a prostitute or with somebody you meet in a bar that night is a really good idea. And of course it is. You would want anyone to do that. But what happened there or really anywhere in the world is for people to use condoms for every sexual encounter with their wives or a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a husband over the course of many years. Generally, as relationships become more serious, they become more intimate, condoms are not part of the picture as much. And so and the additional problem is that it's not a very well understood fact that HIV is kind of hard to spread. So if you're thinking that the one night with a prostitute is going to give you HIV, but you think that someone who, you know, a girlfriend who you have sex with, you know, once a week for years is not going to give you HIV, that's a critical kind of logical mistake. And so if the conversation doesn't focus on long-term sexual behavior, it doesn't focus on sexual networks, you're not giving people the information they need to protect themselves adequately.
And as the UN and various other Western agencies came in with in many cases, billions of dollars, this is clearly one of the mistakes that was made.
That's right, and it's easy to see why, frankly, right? I mean, condoms have been effective in lots of places. It's slowing down the spread of HIV. In the American gay community, use of condoms clearly was an important factor. In Thailand, where HIV was spread predominantly in brothels, they were remarkably effective. So it's easy to see how policymakers would have thought, oh, all we need to do is bring in 10, 20, 30 million condoms, get people to use them, and everything's going to be okay. And what wasn't understood were these more subtle kinds of social and sexual dynamics that were at play in these parts of Africa with very high HIV rates. And the other thing, frankly, was a kind of queasiness with discussing this. There's a big difference between saying to somebody, please use this condom every time you have sex, or these condoms every time you have sex. That's just such a different message from saying, you know what, it's not, if you have sex not just with your wife but with a girlfriend, the likelihood that you're going to get HIV is much higher, and the likelihood that you're going to give HIV to somebody else is much higher. That is, it involves intruding in people's cultures and personal lives to an extent that made many Westerners very uncomfortable. And so, it was the unease of some very well-meaning people to discuss this very private matter openly that got in the way of programs that might well have been more effective and saved many more lives.
Mm-hmm. And which there had been some local indigenous examples of, as we talked about before, but many of those efforts were abandoned.
Right. I hate to be this crass about it, but, you know, money does talk. When you come into a place with billions of dollars about, and you're saying, you know, if you do X, Y, Z, you can save your society, and we also can build you this hospital, and we can fund this program that gives a lot of jobs. That is a very profound, it's a profoundly distracting force. And so there's a little bit of kind of abdicating that I think happened in some places, where these outsiders come in, they seem to know exactly what they're doing. They have huge piles of money that are unlike what you would otherwise see in these countries. And it had a way of taking the emphasis away from where people's own natural instincts were. I mean, AIDS is a really scary thing. When you watch your brother, your sister, your mm-hmm. parents die of it, believe me, it got people's attentions. And what they were able to do in the places where behavior really changed, such as Uganda, such as Zimbabwe, what really happened is people were just terrified. And when people are terrified, when you give them useful advice, they tend to listen. And at the same time, if you come in and say, you know, all you have to do is use this condom and everything's going to be okay, or you say, you know, if you can convince these teenagers to delay sex until they're married, everything's going to be okay. When you give these kind of somewhat simple messages, they can have an effect that is not entirely good.
To what degree did how to proceed get caught up in the culture debates here in the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a really great question. One of the things we chronicle in the book is that the political and cultural battle over sexuality more generally in our society really comes to infect the discussion about AIDS policy all over the world. You have the left, which believes absolutely in the power of condoms to turn back HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases as well. You have the right, some of whom believe absolutely that that if you can merely promote abstinence, if you can get kids to have sex later, if you can get people to only have sex within marriages, that everything will be fine. And so that debate really dominates the conversation about AIDS policy. You'll go back a decade into the early Bush administration. It's front and center. It goes on for years. People today still believe, it was all those abstinence programs that threw things off the rails. And the left says, the right will say, oh, it's the emphasis on condoms that threw things off the rails. When, in fact, neither in the end mattered all that much. They both did valuable things. There's definitely people alive today that wouldn't be alive if those programs hadn't happened. But the core questions about sexual behavior more broadly fell out of the debate to a huge extent. And that was a true tragedy.
As there became some ways to treat the disease through these antiviral drugs, how did things go so remarkably badly in South Africa during the Mbeki years?
Yeah, it was. I caught the tail end of this disaster when I was a foreign correspondent down in South Africa, and beginning in 2004. The president there, Thabo Mbeki, who is this brilliant economist, impressive in almost every possible way, really missed the boat on AIDS, and he fell under the sway of a group of American theorists who argued that HIV didn't cause AIDS, who argued that the real underlying factor was poverty and poor health care. And so at the exact time when these miraculous AIDS drugs were becoming available to even poor countries in Africa and beyond, South Africa resisted. So you could have been, for example, just over the border in a neighboring country, Botswana, where the government believed entirely in these drugs, and beginning in, say, 2003, certainly by 2004, you could walk up to any government clinic and get that medicine, and you would live years, maybe decades longer. If you were on the South African side of the border, you were in a political culture that was hostile to this medicine, who saw this medicine as a kind of trick of the pharmaceutical industry, and lots of people died. Lots of people who could have gotten on the medicine if the South African government had been more aggressive about buying it and distributing died. Some estimates put it in the hundreds of thousands, and that is another one of the great tragedies of this story.
And that goes along to some extent with the broader issue we've been talking about, that as the West got more involved, it became harder to talk about all of these things.
Yeah, boy, it's hard to lay that one exactly at the West's feet. I mean, if you think about the epidemic broadly, the conversation tends to fall into one or two categories. There's how people get HIV in the first place, and then there's what you do with people once they're infected. And on the second half of that equation, the treating people, the West impact has been truly remarkable. What the Bush administration pioneered with its PEPFAR campaign, with $15 billion in getting AIDS drugs to people in Africa, I mean, in terms of treating people and extending their lives, it was astonishing to see. When I arrived in 2004, it was awfully hard to get those drugs in most parts of the continent. By the time I left in 2008, it was easy to get those drugs most places, and it was becoming easier even in South Africa, which had resisted. It's really on the prevention side that this thing was not successful, where outsiders have really struggled to have useful impact. And so part of the underlying story is that in Western society, we tend to believe in the power of medicine, right? You know, our children get sick, we take them to the doctor, we give them vaccines. And that works for the huge majority of medical maladies that we deal with in our own lives. In places that don't have the kind of medical infrastructure we have here in the United States, that equation doesn't work as well. And in particular, it doesn't work as well when you're dealing with an incurable sexually transmitted epidemic. In those instances, you need societies, ideally, to kind of have a frank conversation with themselves. And anything that keeps that from happening it becomes in the long run a problem.
Of course, the other side of that same coin is that as we have gotten better and better about treating it, and those medicines are more and more available, it's been harder in some respects to bring the broader epidemic under control.
Yeah, this is one of the truly upsetting conundrums in the middle of this whole debate. you would like to think that that people who have watched their friends and relatives die would be so profoundly impacted by that experience that they would necessarily do everything humanly possible to keep from getting sick themselves, right? The nature of human psychology turns out to be a little bit more different than that, and it's not just in Africa. It's in the American gay community. It's in Europe. The fact is that when people fear things less, they're less likely to take precautions against it, and that includes the danger of driving too fast. People who have seatbelts are a little less likely to drive slowly. It affects the use of sunblock. People who wear a lot of sunblock are more likely to lay in the sun all day long because they're not as afraid of getting sunburned. And so when it comes to a disease like AIDS, people who think it's a manageable disease are going to work less hard to prevent themselves from getting it. And you can see that play out in places in Africa and around the world where these amazing AIDS drugs are most available, and the fear has gone down a little bit. It becomes a little harder to convince people that maybe a significant change in personal behavior is worth the trouble.
And what is the state of the epidemic today in parts of Africa?
You know, the spread of HIV has been slowing pretty much everywhere in the world since the late 90s and early part of this century. All epidemics go through a period where they're spreading very quickly, and then they peak and they begin to decline, even if there's no meaningful human intervention. That's true of cholera. It's true of the flu. Because the people most vulnerable get it, and they either they learn to live with it or they die from it. So there's a natural curve to the way epidemics move through societies. So across Africa, while more than, I think it's 20-some million people still have HIV, nearly 30 million people still have HIV, the spread is somewhat slower than it used to be. The crucial factor, though, is what is the trajectory now? And in the societies where really concerted action happened to slow the spread of the disease, you see this very sharp decline in new infections. And in other places, you see what you might think of as a long, slow slide. So in country A, where the prevention campaigns have been really effective, you might see the number of new cases fall from, a million a year to 300,000 a year. And in places where you have not had a profound change in behavior, you may see cases go from a million a year to 950,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So great for those 50,000 people, but there's hundreds of thousands of others who could potentially be protected from this disease if a broader and more significant shift happened.
And is there the danger of the disease reemerging in a slightly mutated form and spreading more rapidly?
Yeah, I suppose there's always some danger of that, but worries about HIV mutating into a form that's hard to treat with antiviral drugs have not really been borne out in a significant way so far. Over time, I think that fear is definitely worth keeping an eye on. But in general, the medical world has gotten very sophisticated at treating this disease once people have it. What we're pretty bad at so far is keeping people from getting it.
Right. And finally, what's the overriding takeaway from this that we might be able to use in dealing with epidemics in the future?
I think part of it is that there was a real failure of science with the AIDS epidemic. The people's cultural and ideological ideas got in the way of clear thinking and clear action. I think we also, as a society, need to remember the limits of what we can do usefully in other parts of the world, even when our intentions are good. That's a lesson that it feels like we have to learn again and again. So being able to stare at the facts, deal with them rationally, and move in a sensible direction, I think that has to be the goal of dealing with any kind of epidemic.
Craig Timberg, he's the co-author, along with Daniel Halperin, of Tinderbox, How the West Sparked the AIDS Epidemic and How the World Can Finally Overcome It. Craig, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
No, it was my great pleasure.
Thank you.